I feel like we've done this topic before, but it's still too hot outside. In honor of Twisters in theater this weekend, what's a weather crisis you'd like to see an upcoming movie about?
I'm Katie Rich, and I feel like the cicada community would say they're animals and not weather, but I just still feel like the 17-year cicadas are insane and would make a good movie.
Like a Jurassic Park movie? You want to...
Maybe? I don't know. I haven't thought it through much more than that.
I'm David the Seven, and recently I've been thinking about some wet bulb temperatures. So I'm going to say 100% humidity, because then your body can't cool down and you'll go into heat stroke at much lower temperatures. 100% humidity. What a fun, thrilling premise for a movie.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with something that we used to have so often. There was a movie about it, and now I think people could only really, kids especially, experience it through a movie. And that, of course, is a snow day.
Ooh.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 480. It is the week of Wednesday, July 17th. That is the day that in 1959, North by Northwest premiered in Los Angeles. I know I said this last week, I think about Escape from New York, but like, would love to have a North by Northwest just open them in our theaters right now.
Yeah.
Right on.
I mean, there's lots of fun stuff at theaters, but yeah, no North by Northwest, I don't think. Yeah, what?
Matt These Patches. Days, you only get South by Southwest.
Oh,
right.
Hey,
and not
hey-o.
Even in the middle of July is a summer movie.
Yeah.
You might have noticed that Matt Patches is not with us, and he's not going to be with us. He's taking a sabbatical, basically, because he's going on a trip, and then he's been sick, and all kinds of things are happening to this poor man. So,
oh no,
he'll
a trip.
He'll be back. He'll be back.
Yeah.
You feel bad for him for getting
well,
to travel.
It's a fun trip, but also it's a fun trip with the whole family. So it's, you know, got its own obstacles. So, you know.
I know I'm currently dreading my own trip coming up, so I hear you.
Yeah. See? So anyway, we're powering through without him, and I don't know, did the people know that he wasn't going to be here, so therefore they didn't leave us any reviews? Is that how this logic works?
I don't necessarily follow, but we have one review. It's a doozy. It's from Patrick in Omaha, who says, pretty good podcast. And then the body of the review says, this is a pretty good podcast.
Nice.
Okay.
Thank you, Patrick in Omaha. Omaha, what's that like? You know, what's the deal with Omaha? They got Twisters out in Omaha?
Jerry Seinfeld over here?
Yeah. What's the deal with Omaha?
What's the deal
with
Omaha?
Omaha. We got some emails too. Do we want to do some emails even though Patches is just near?
Yeah, I think we gotta, right?
All right.
I think I just exhausted myself not making a comment about Jerry Seinfeld in Israel. Just like the restraint has drained me for the evening, so I'm out.
Well, I'll pivot off.
Wait, is Jerry Seinfeld back out there talking about Israel again? Is
no,
that what's
but he for all eternity will be out there talking about Israel. So
it's just on just top
yeah.
Of
I mean,
mind
I'm certainly not
going to
think about him in another context. The foreseeable future.
I will pivot off of the David not liking Jerry Seinfeld for very valid reasons into this email titled or subject line, an apology to Ehrlich. Greetings, War Room. Several months back, I posted a review on Apple Podcasts in which I said some not nice things about David Ehrlich, including that I wanted to be warned. I'm sorry.
I was just booing in the listener's direction.
Included that I wanted to be warned about which episodes he would be on so I could skip them. However, in the weeks after the episode in which the review was read, David was absent for several episodes, and it was then I realized how crucial a part of the show he is. My main complaint in my review was how negative David could be, but the review was read in the episode where you all talked about Unfrosted, and I was grateful for David in that episode. For lambasting that film for the travesty it is.
Staying on topic here.
Whether I agree with David or not isn't even the point. The point for me is once I heard my review read out loud on the podcast, I realized that the irritation I sometimes feel towards David and his penchant for interrupting, I had allowed myself to become the most dreaded of creatures, the internet troll. I have also really come to appreciate what a good sport David is when dealing with all of his haters. While David's takes often don't resonate with me personally, he still provides a balance on the show and is part of what makes it a great podcast. I'm sorry for my harsh words. Keep up the good work, everyone.
Well, you know, live, die a hero, or I don't know what fucking Dark Knight quote I can apply here, but nice to live long enough. But I appreciate that it was my absence that made this listener come around.
It made the heart grow fonder.
No, but certainly I don't think my presence in these episodes of the last few weeks, the episodes that I have been on anyway, would have brought anyone around to the cause. So the logic checks out. Thank you for sticking with us. The boo has been also reconsidered into a yay.
I like the idea that by being mad at David Ehrlich, it really brings out the parts of yourself you need to analyze. Like, it's kind of like going to therapy.
Honestly, it's what anyone who takes shit on the internet wants to hear most of all, that like you have looked into a mirror and reconsidered, you know, thought deeply about your own malaise.
Your whole life.
We have a long email from Doug who has thoughts about Inside Out that is actually long enough that I think it's going to forward it to you guys. But Doug, like your email, but this last one is also on the recanting things about David Ehrlich theme and the accidentally not read on the air email theme. So here we go. This is from Eliza. The subject is rude. Given that it's now been months since I sent the below and it has yet to be read on the show, I formally retract. I no longer feel strongly about David dissing my city. I, like David, am an avid and enthusiastic hater of many things, and I'd never deny a fellow misanthrope the pleasure of a good takedown. With love and squalor, Eliza, and the original thing that we did not read on the podcast for, I don't know, it was back in May, so reasons. I grew up in NYC, but came to Providence for art school, and I've lived here ever since. It is, in fact, populated by people, and it happens to be a wonderful place to live, and it's not even controlled by the mafia anymore. And just yesterday, I toured a three-bedroom apartment.
That's what the mafia would say, but okay.
That's what they want you to think.
And just yesterday, I toured a three-bedroom apartment that was $1,200 a month. Get bent, Ehrlich. Katie, your new podcast is delightful. I can't wait to hear more.
I mean, if you want to hit below the belt, telling me your rent is definitely going to do the trick. And I'm sure the $1,200 you pay a month in Providence buys you a palace compared to the hovel that my more than $1,200 a month buys me or rents me in Brooklyn.
You're allowed to hate it because the retraction came. So by blessed me forgetting to read some things on the podcast, you've been forgiven and you're allowed to hate Providence because you got a fellow misanthrope.
I mean, my then girlfriend, now wife, when she lived off campus at RISD, not that RISD has a campus, I don't think, but adjacent to Brown, she lived in the most beautiful. They lived in the first floor of the most beautiful house on a hill up there, and for a fraction of what we pay now. And so,
you could be
jealous.
Living that life right now.
Could be living. I could just commute on the Acela every time I need to come into a screening. I'm sure the math would not quite add up in terms of the cost, but
there's regional film screenings in Providence, at least in Boston.
Yeah,
If I had my press screening of Twisters here, you can figure out a way to see it in Providence.
Sure, you could.
Twisters being.
I'd rather see Twisters in Omaha, though.
That's true. It'd be too much of a 4DX experience.
That's true.
The theater's not built to withstand what's coming. We'll get there.
We'll definitely get there.
Get everyone in the movie theater.
There tornadoes in Omaha.
Definitely are tornadoes in Omaha. Definitely.
We'll have to figure this out later.
I'm just going to say, EF2s are rare in Omaha. The last documented one was on, there are two of them actually, on December 15th, 2021. EF3s, and we all know now the terminology, having recently rewatched Twisters.
Yes, I know.
Of course, seeing Twisters. EF3s are almost unheard of in the Omaha area.
Which is not to say that
EF2s are nothing to sneeze at. Right. I mean, we also know that they measure them by their destructive power and not their size, even though those two things may be correlated. I don't know. But I'm sure EF2s are nothing to sneeze at, ditto EF1s. But anyway, in case anyone was suddenly getting nervous about their trip to Omaha, you should be okay.
You could get stuff read on this podcast most of the time by emailing us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com or leaving us a review on the Apple Podcast app, and then later you could email us about that review and take parts of it back. It's all good with us, man. Let's get on with the show.
It's all good, man. It's the dream. I have not seen Long Legs, so I will listen with interest.
Okay.
I'm not going to see try to convince me to see Long Legs.
Maybe I like that. I like that for a premise. David, how would you describe to Katie Rich, who does not want to see Long Legs, what Long Legs is about?
What is Long Legs about?
It's got Long like a it's got like a dash of like, let's say Silence of the Lambs. But like,
yeah, I mean, I guess like the really reductive way of describing it, and I'm certainly not alone in describing it this way, would be sort of that it's a cross between the Silence of the Lambs and Kiyoshi Kurosawa's Cure. In that
okay,
it takes like a
serial
kill.
That's not getting me too
I
far
know.
About
I don't
where
think,
I need to
yeah,
be here.
I certainly don't think by the end of the segment you're going to be all that more inclined to go see the movie, but I guess we can work on you understanding what it is. It takes the elements of a serial killer procedural, all of which you know well and near and dear to your heart, and combines them with a sort of psychosocial and eventually supernatural bent. Although it wears its supernaturalism a while incontrovertibly, lightly as well. I mean, I think it really is trying to bridge the gap between those two, and it can't cheat too much in one direction without, you know, not being able to do that. But essentially serial killer. See, Nicolas Cage plays a serial killer named Long Legs. We know that his name is Long Legs because the opening credits say Nicolas Cage as Long Legs. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, in case you were thinking that you're going to be thrown for a loop, Adam or living
ghost,
in a cave.
As we call it. It's the Hatbox Ghost.
Except for unlike the Hatbox Ghost, he's actually in this fucking movie, although not that much. But
were you mad that Jared went not to relitigate Haunted Mansion? But was more Jared Leto what that movie needed?
Yes. I would say more Jared Leto is what this movie needed and less Nicolas Cage is what this movie needed.
Hang on, you wanted more Jared Leto in Long Legs? Let's be clear about our choice.
If the Hatbox Ghost wandered into Long Legs, it would it would explain a lot. It would raise some more questions, but it would also answer several others. For the last 40 years in the Portland area, in the rural areas outside of Portland, really, there have been these murders, all the same. A good church-going family man that no one could say a bad thing about, suddenly, around the time of their daughter's birthday, particularly a birthday that occurred in the middle of the month, butchered their entire family before killing themselves in most gruesome fashion. And the only thing other than the identity of the victims that were getting these crimes together and allowed the FBI to realize there was a serial killer at work was the fact that our friend Long Legs would leave a birthday card that he would sign with a $12 check. No, I'm just kidding. that he would sign behind saying like holiday greetings, Long Legs, whatever the fuck you write in your birthday card. And
it's a cipher. It's like a Zodiac.
It's
cipher.
A cipher. Yeah, sure. It's a Zodiac cipher. And it is. He's laying the groundwork for the social media campaign that would eventually propel the documentary Neon made about him to box office riches. This goes on for decades. No one can figure out what's what. But then this girl, Lee Harker, one of the great serial killer movie names.
She's a special agent for the FBI, Lee Harker.
Yeah. She displays some sort of psychic ability while rooting out a different serial killer. She's able to sort of sense where he is. And so the FBI puts her in a control/Alan Wake-like test, where they determine that she does have some sort of paranormal ability, and Blair Underwood is her captain. He rules in this movie. He assigns her to the Long Legs case, and it takes all of about 6 seconds before Long Legs makes things very personal for her. That's your Long Legs. And she's trying to stop him, and he's like, I'm not going to be stopped. I'm going to kill again. And what's going to happen? Who's going to win? Gets a little bit more complicated than that. Alicia Witt plays her estranged, very religious mother, who doesn't seem to have the warmest relationship with her. A comment made early in the movie about how Blair Underwood's daughter's birthday party is coming up hangs ominously in the air. And things eventually come together as you'd expect they would. Katie, do you feel like you have a decent sense of what the movie Long Legs is about now?
I do. As someone who doesn't see most horror movies, and I keep hearing this year about how horror movies aren't doing that well, people aren't running out to get these, I can't totally square what sounds like a fine movie with Neon's biggest opening ever and what sounds like a genuine phenomenon. I haven't been able to figure that out.
Well, a lot of it boils back to the marketing campaign, which I think is sort of a work of art unto itself, completely separate from the finished product of the movie, aside from the cipher, which is very convenient, for marketing purposes. I'm not so cynical to suggest that it's only in the movie for that reason. I don't think Oz Perkins would do that, but convenient nonetheless. I was personally frustrated by their strategy of showing it only to horror press and therefore raising the hype from very, very receptive audiences to, unreachable levels, and allowing those reviews to go live. This is very, very rare in our business that anyone would do this, where they allow before the trades get a chance to do anything else, just this one genre.
Well, it's like
press.
Having a Comic-Con screening 10 years ago or something, right?
Yeah,
like,
but many times over thing. And on a rolling basis for a couple of months. And I think that coupled with the very effective and cryptic advertising campaign, which reminded all of us something that Robert Zemeckis tried to make everyone forget 25 years ago. People are more interested in trailers when they don't show what's in the actual movie.
About the marketing campaign. Are you talking about the trailers? I kept feeling there was I'm now sounding like an idiot. There was viral marketing stuff with this that I was vaguely aware of.
There was some viral marketing stuff. They did some YouTube videos that had a cipher that I think they eventually printed in a paper or had paid to print in a paper so it would eventually make its way back online.
And they had Long Legs sit behind home plate at a Yankees game.
Really?
That's Smile. Not true.
And then they just sort of did this trailer campaign where for a long time they weren't even saying what the movie was called, and then they did this heartbeat campaign. I don't know if you saw it.
No, that was maybe a slight misstep towards the end.
Either way, there was a bunch of campaign imagery that this was going to be maybe the scariest movie ever made.
And the heartbeat thing is the closest. The silliness of that is the closest.
What is that? I don't know what that
campaign
is.
It's they had a heart monitor on Micah Monroe the first time she saw Nicolas Cage in full makeup on the one day of the movie they did a scene together. And they were like, Micah Monroe's heartbeat spiked to 900 beats a minute. And she died. They released that, and it was silly in a way that more accurately reflects the tone of the movie than the very severe and cryptic ad campaign, which I found very effective and spoke to me the kind of movie I wanted to see.
And Ari Aster horror thing is what they're going for, right? Like, this is Neon going into the elevated horror A24 thing.
Yeah, but I think that, and the reason I was frustrated about the screening strategy is because the expectation it set, I was frustrated because the expectation for the kind of horror movie that the marketing campaign set didn't align with the movie that I saw. And I think that led me to enjoy it maybe even less than I would have otherwise. But I also just the hype was so immense that when I saw it and wrote it's fine review, people were ready to crucify me, which I did not appreciate. Although already in the week since the movie's come out, people... clearer heads have prevailed. This is always what happens. And this is water off a duck's back. Not a big deal, but whatever. But the movie is a lot sillier than I thought it was going to be. I liked it most over the first 30 minutes or so when it is the movie you could infer from that ad campaign. It's completely filled with the way I described it in my review, sort of the dread of an indifferent world where, people... will be slaughtered, and we see her partner in that scene where they're finding the other serial killer who gets very abruptly shot. With no consideration, it's a cold and unforgiving world, and the dread of that and how deep that idea settles into the bones of this movie, I found effective, and it is very strongly complemented by Oz Perkins, by the austerity of his direction, which is very locked off, very chilling. It is focusing your attention on the negative spaces, the empty spaces around his characters. There's a long shot, long in duration, if not necessarily in its distance, from the character where Lee is sitting at her desk, and there's just this big empty space, the door frame of her office behind her. And I spent what felt like a short eternity, like, you know, staring in dread at that space, waiting for something to fill it. I won't reveal whether or not anything does, but it's like, that is the kind of horror that I found very unsettling. Just the idea that the world itself is evil, as opposed to when you have more jump scares, there's, whoa, was that thunder? I think it was thunder. They're like jump scare it's thunder. A jump scare. Boom. There are, it's like a thing is evil, right? You're waiting for this thing. It's a clench and release. It pops out. You can breathe because you know that's over. That is antithetical to what this movie is trying to do, where it's trying to saturate the world with horror. It is inescapable. There are a few jump scares here and there, some of them which are used to introduce title cards. But that, those are the terms the movie's working on when it's really effective for me. As Long Legs comes more into the fore as a character, and we get a clearer plot has to come into place, it's the undoing of a movie like this that sustains atmosphere a lot better than it does storytelling detail, and things begin to fall apart and feel very silly. And by the end, I was kind of rolling my eyes and laughing at the, you know, the supposed tension of it all. And for that reason, the movie didn't sit particularly well with me, you know, in the time after. But I think, you know, when it's cooking in that first half, and when it's focusing on like that visceral theme of the, of sort of the evil in the world, the fact that like the things that we tell our children when they are young to put them at ease and keep them safe, are little white lies that can have dire consequences. That resonated with me.
Dave, is David asking too much of a movie called Long Legs?
Oh, I don't think so. I would just put it a different way, which is this movie starts off so FBI procedural. I thought it would have maybe something broader or bigger in its plot that ultimately starts feeling claustrophobic. And you realize that's where the movie was going all of the time, that you just maybe had a different expectation from the beginning to like the end, because I initially thought that was a bad thing right after the movie ended. But then like the days after I've seen it now, I found myself like going to the horror section of whatever streaming service and sort of like looking for a way to juice what I thought that made Long Legs good. And I don't know if it really exists. Maybe the interesting thing about this movie is it's sort of like weird structure that makes it sort of work more like an incantation than like a plotted film. Because you start off expecting something, I think, a little bit more like Silence of the Lambs, or at least I did. But like Thomas Harris is like super plotty and super into implying why, you know, his killers are the way that they are, if we don't get like a full-on backstory. And Longlegs sort of like isn't that. It's like, you know, at the bottom is creepiness and Satanism, and that's sort of as like detailed as it's interested in getting. And so by the time it did start trying to pile on sort of that plot that I was expecting earlier on in the film, we'd already transitioned to almost like a fairy tale, hazy vagueness, claustrophobia, that when, you know, the quote unquote solutions are presented to me at the back half of this movie, it feels, I don't know, more intuitive than it does make logical sense to me.
I don't know. I'm as guilty of anyone as being in the tank for the movies that people would classify as elevated horror over the more programmatic genre stuff. But I don't think, like, I don't know. I struggle with that. I want more from horror movies. I want them to scare me. I want them to unsettle me. I want them to work with big ideas. I want them to be viscerally effective. I want some combination of that thing, of those things.
Yeah. I mean, I think we ended up giving it like almost the same score on Letterboxd, which means like we're saying the same thing. I just wasn't super disappointed in it. I do agree that the marketing was sort of pushing you just to get into the theaters, because it's a very different movie.
I would say the drop-off in my reaction was less steep from the marketing to the movie than it was from the first 30 minutes of the movie to the last 30 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
And you know, there are people who will appreciate and sort of vibe with the sillier direction that it goes. I mean, I would be hard-pressed, anecdotally, to find someone who thought the last 10 seconds of this movie was a good choice that but dovetailed with what they wanted this movie to be. But surely, you know, if that's you and you're out there, let us know on Fighting in the War Room, the podcast app. But I mean, like, there's place for some silliness here. Kiernan Shipka, who
will be coming back later in this episode.
great, you know, she's great in both Twisters and this. In a limited capacity, she's in Twisters anyway. But she has a one scene cameo where she's effectively like doing the true and talking. In a way, I don't know how to describe other than that, but and that she really threads the needle between silliness and the creepiness of this movie, and it's like when the movie is starting to allow some levity into it as well, and like that worked for me, and then just tipped the scales too much in the other direction. But
it's sort of like at like 30 minutes into this movie you're gonna realize you met your last normal person for the rest of the movie. And so, like, you keep meeting new characters and you keep uncovering new things, but, like, all these people are deeply creepy and weird in, like, that more, you know, base hypnotic. I don't know. The director, Oz Perkins, this seems like a... I've seen The Black Coat's Daughter and I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. This seems like a blend between the two things to me. The sort of, like, more murderous Satanism of Black Coat's Daughter and the sort of, like, weird lyrical haunting if I'm the pretty thing that lives in the house. It's those two things in a blender with Nicolas Cage being like, can I do a makeup based performance? And it's like, we know he can, so let's see what it is.
And his performance feels very unrestrained. I mean, it feels
what?
I read somewhere but I read somewhere that, like, you know, Oz Perkins didn't really feel comfortable sort of sculpting Nicolas Cage's performance, that he's like, he just hired Nicolas Cage and he got what he got, and what he got I just didn't feel was particularly right for this movie, and it does sort of force his hand in terms of the tone of where things go,
but then it ends the way that you were sort of hinting at, which sort of makes it seem like that is
right,
the tone.
I mean,
my
feeling was he had to sort of succumb to that eventually. It was like, there's no escaping this is what it is. Or maybe not. I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions to the thought process behind the movie because it's ultimately irrelevant. But it certainly feels that way. I mean, I think that story, wherever I read it, or the quote that I'm extrapolating, felt credible because it feels that way when you're watching the movie, that it was sort of hijacked by someone who didn't have the movie's best interests in mind. But,
well, yeah,
so it goes.
I think he's talked about it being like sort of about, you know, his dad, Anthony Perkins, being in the closet and dying. And his mom sort of like carried the secret for a little while longer after his death than him.
Yeah, he's talked a lot about being like a tribute to his mother.
Yeah.
Which, when you've seen the movie, is like agreeably perverse of an idea.
Right. But then if it doesn't end the
agreeably
way.
Agreeably perverse, David.
If it doesn't end the way it does and it's called a tribute to his mother, then it's like actually kind of fucked up. So, like, if it is a tribute, then I understand why it ends the way it does. But, like, either way, weird little movie, log legs. You know what? It's doing pretty well. If you want to see it in theaters, go for it. If you don't want to see it, Katie, that's fine, too. Nicolas Cage is going to be fine with that, I think.
Yeah.
Cool that it's doing well. It's good for the gander. Yeah, not a terrible film. Try not to walk crooked while this anchor's drop. But I've been out on them choppy ways, and it's hard to say when this land begins and that water stops. I got sea legs.
Well, we just had a segment where I got to ask you guys what the deal was with long legs. That felt like really obvious, basic questions about like viral marketing. So I can monologue about the Emmys, or you guys can ask me questions of things that you think feel relevant.
I got a question about the Emmys.
What's your question? Why do they
exist?
Didn't
the Emmys just happen?
They sure did. They did just happen.
And wasn't it just Oscar season sort of way? I mean,
no,
literally,
like,
they just fucking happened.
Well, they got delayed from September to January because of the strike last year. So, yes, we've already had an Emmys this year. They're going to happen again in September. They're going to award some of the same shows because the
what
Bear.
What season of the Bear are we setting now?
This is season two. So we're up to Jamie Lee Curtis and her episodes and MMS Bacharach and the Forks and everything. That's the season.
How many nominations did Love Island USA, the current season, get? Or was it not eligible?
You know, let me pull that up. I have all of these things. I don't know about the current season. I don't know what the eligibility. Love Island got no.
I don't think Love Island.
Next year.
Below
next year it's sweeping.
Below Decks might.
Love on the Spectrum got in there?
Nah. Yes, Love on the Spectrum did, definitely.
I know you don't love the U.S. Traitors the way you love the U.K. Traitors, but it did get a reality competition nomination, and Alan Cumming got a host nomination, which did not happen last year, so I was thrilled by that.
Yeah. The Love Island will get a similar bump next season.
I think we can assume that.
I'm very happy they nominated Only Murders in the Building, since I thought I was the only one left watching that show.
Yeah, I think a lot of people thought that maybe it had fallen off for its third season, and the opposite happened. It got nominated a bunch of places that hasn't before, like Selena Gomez got in for the first time. Paul Rudd and Meryl Streep both got nominations. So yes, Dave,
but surely the curse is the juggernaut of this year's awards, right?
Well, do you know how some people like the curse and some people were like, absolutely not, I want to crawl out of my skin when I watch the curse? All of those latter people are in the TV Academy, so it got blanked completely.
Oh wow.
Which is not necessarily surprising. I think some people thought Emma Stone would get in because her performance really is incredible, but I think probably most of the people were like, absolutely not, I cannot deal with this show. And you can't blame them on some level.
What's the biggest lock?
Shogun got all the huge nominations that they said it would. It got 25 nominations total. Although Cosmo Jarvis, who plays the engine, Blackthorn? Mm-hmm. How did I forget that already? He didn't get nominated, which was kind of surprising. But here
season
he's
two.
Not a, well... Actually, I mean, nobody really knows what they're doing with season two, and spoilers for Shogun, his character is still theoretically in play, so who knows? Apple got a bunch of nominations for a bunch of stuff that you don't think anybody watches, like Palm Royale or Loot, which I think I've talked about and liked. Maya Rudolph got in there. It got a bajillion nominations for The Morning Show. Did you guys know that A, Mark Duplass is on The Morning Show, and B, is now an Emmy nominee for The Morning Show?
I forgot The Morning Show was still doing a thing.
Still kicking. Reese Witherspoon was at the Capitol on January 6th in the world of The Morning Show for the news. Not like a rioter.
Didn't even think.
Jay Duplass get the very deserving nomination for his performance in Industry Season 2?
I don't think it's eligible. I think Industry Season 2 must have been for last time around. But Industry's coming back for Season 3. I gotta catch
sure
up on it.
Sure fucking is.
Yeah, I know you know that.
I got the screeners ready to go. Locked and loaded.
Lots of things to choose from in there.
I can say that in context of a television show, right, FBI?
But we're just going to let that one
These
go.
These days, I just nothing safe.
Do we ever talk about Ripley amongst ourselves? I watched it kind of in a rush when I was between jobs and knew I was going to be covering the Emmys.
I also watched it. I think we had to have watched it for the show, right?
We must have talked about it.
I indeed saw every episode.
I was delighted that it got 13 nominations. I thought that it would kind of get drowned out. Netflix was pushing Baby Reindeer really hard, which also got a bunch of nominations. But like Dakota Fanning got in. I think Robert Elswit's cinematography is hopefully a huge lock. I never know with those tech categories. But wasn't just us who liked Ripley.
How is the internet reacting to Dune 2 being snubbed in every category?
The way that you take these awards so seriously that are my livelihood,
judging by the reaction to IndieWire's list of the best films of 2024 so far,
you
I would imagine they are
Dune
up in arms.
You guys left Dune 2 off of that list?
Yeah.
You are a bunch of maniacs.
The
Emmys, Shogun and the Bear and Baby Reindeer are going to win a bunch of stuff, which is what we all do. Oh, here's something to end it on. Did you know Unfrosted got a Emmy nomination, David? You ready for this?
I that is
for what?
That's crushing news.
For a television movie. The television movie category is truly bonkers.
Is that one of the Emmys they show on the broadcast, or is that like a red carpet?
I think it goes back. Well, there's the Creative Arts Emmys, which happened the weekend before. They don't do the red carpet.
There are like
that's
seven Emmys.
Choice Awards. Yeah, there's a lot of Emmys. There's sports Emmys. There's daytime Emmys. The TV movie category is reliably crazy. So you get Mr. Monk's Last Case, a Monk movie. Quiz Lady, which Jordan Hoffman, who joined me on the Ankler podcast to talk about it, if you guys want to hear from him. Red, White, and Royal Blue, which is like barely a movie. Scoop, the like Netflix movie about Prince Andrew and Unfrosted. I don't know who's going to, like, maybe Mr. Monk's Last Case wins. I can't even tell you what's going to happen there.
I mean, but
this is like all streaming films would be eligible, no? Like straight to streaming films?
Apparently.
Yes.
And those
like,
are the ones
like
they
last
chose?
Year in TV movie, like the Weird Al movie won, and Prey, the Dan Trachtenberg Predator movie, because it went straight to Hulu, was eligible. Like Fire
right.
Island got nominated here. Like we're kind of past that, like movies that should have been in theaters here. Like,
but
I
are you allowed to submit to, I should know the answer to this question by now. I just choose not to think about it. But if you submit for the Oscars, does it disqualify you from submitting to the Emmys? Because like, why would May December not be nominated,
they
for example?
Wait, what? Why would May December be?
Because it's Netflix
like,
movie.
Yeah, so if you submit to the Oscars, yeah, I don't think you can submit to the Emmy. This did not used to be the case. Like, O.J. Made America won an Emmy and an Oscar, and then kind of after that was when they tamped down on the rules. I honestly don't remember how the rules go back and forth, and I think if, like, you're a documentary and you don't get nominated or make the shortlist for the Oscars, then you could resubmit for the next year's. There's some complication to that, but more or less, no, you can't do that. And nor should you be able to, I would say. Nor should you. Anyway, that's the Emmys. It'll be in September. You can hear me talk more about it with Jordan, which was honestly a delight because he doesn't follow any of this stuff in as much detail. So like there were tangents about the shows his mom watches and Star Trek and all kinds of other stuff. So just listen to that.
Jordan Hoffman's mom and me.
Watch Slow Horses?
Can meet in the middle on Slow Horses.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's high on my list of things I got to catch up on now.
Twisters, we are back, I guess, in the world of Twister, although the only way you would know that is the machine Dorothy makes a very early appearance in this movie.
Just to reassure you that they haven't forgotten the true star.
Yeah, they're like, Twister. We know they have that and they have the font and then they have the concept of tornado chasing.
I feel like Maura Tierney was spiritually in Twister.
Okay.
Like when she shows up in Twisters, I was like, that makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. I have no
well, it's
notes.
Like she was like on the set of Iron Claw, was just like, oh, can you just come next door for a second and like just be a different mom? And she's like, sure, okay.
I like to think that was the Helen Hunt part, and they were like, you know what? We don't need that. This could be its own thing.
We're like really jumping ahead, but I was so convinced that Helen Hunt would be in it, and I was very surprised that she wasn't. But you know what? It's maybe
you didn't
not stay the
for
vibe
after
of
the credits.
Movie. When,
Helen Hunt is recruited, shows up to recruit Daisy Edgar Jones into the Tornado Initiative.
This is from Minari director Lee Isaac Chung as we catch up with more traumatic tornadoes. Daisy Edgar Jones plays Kate, a meteorologist who is trying to write her paper on wrangling's not her term for it, but it's also taming a tornado.
Taming tornadoes,
where they send an absorbent material up into the tornado to make it sort of dissolve. Her first field experiment goes poorly, causing the death of some members of her team, and a couple
we
years later
here in Shipka.
They're here, and then in some photos throughout the movie.
People really get, I mean, this isn't going to come as much as a surprise to anyone who goes to see this movie, but people really get sucked up into tornadoes in this film.
Yeah, that is
like,
true.
In ways that they did not, we didn't have the technology to tornado suck people like this back in the 90s, but now they're getting sucked up left and right.
And very specifically, feet away from somebody who is safe because of wind dynamics, people get sucked up. Anyway. Kate sure. Has a bad time out in the field, so 5 years later she's working basically a desk job in New York, when she's called back by her old friend Anthony Ramos, who has been doing some work for the military, and then came back with this knowledge on a very special type of radar. He is now working for a company and wants her to come out so he could use this radar to get some data on tornadoes, and while they're there, they run into another group of storm chasers led by Glenn Powell as Tyler, who is a YouTube star along with his crew of roustabouts and ne'er-do-wells who run this YouTube channel chasing tornadoes. And it looks like it's going to be a reverse of the original Twister, where instead of being on the side of the roustabouts, we are on the side of the big corporation. And instead of putting a marriage together after a divorce, we are going to do a rom-com. And away we go into Twisters as these personalities bounce off each other as they, you know, try to chase
really
down tornadoes.
You didn't think we were going
to
be on the side of the corporate people the whole really? Like, the minute that, like, that RV that looks just like the one Philip Seymour Hoffman drove in the original shows up, you're like, oh, well, these are going to be our guys. We just got to, like, figure out how to get
there.
They
are not subtle about layering in hints that something fishy is going on with the people that...
Anthony Ramos is always like, don't worry about it. I'm just going to go talk to this rich guy.
Yeah, I'm just going to talk to the businessman in the bolo tie.
I'm just going to go talk to Montgomery Burns over here. What's happening?
Well, yeah, and you've got the charisma kind of exuding out of all of, like, not just Glenn Powell, who we can talk about, but, like, the minute that the ragtag group shows up, even though they're a bunch of YouTube assholes, which is such a perfect way to set that up for the modern day. Like, you absolutely believe there being a Mr. Beast of tornadoes who would go shoot fireworks up into them and then have a bunch of hangers on.
The fact that they're YouTube assholes is such a great shortcut to getting us to be suspicious of them and, like, to feel like we are being won over to them along with Daisy Edgar Jones. And then, of course, it turns out that they all have hearts of gold and they're doing things for altruistic reasons. But, like, and it also helps. I mean, you know, part of the inevitability of this is that they are doing their best. Lee Isaac Chung is doing his best with what's available to him to match up to the, like, all-time insane cast of character actors from Twister.
Yep.
And I think he does and the studios around him and whoever was helping put together this cast do a pretty good job of working with what's available today to, like, stack up as best they can.
Yes.
I don't know if the cast is used as well as they were in Twister, but you get, like, an entire A24 movie bumped off before, you know, the first 5 minutes of the film. And then you got Sasha Lane, American Honey herself, is one of the crew. And they all have their own little special skills. It's very nice. You've got Brendan Perea of Nope fame. You have Katie O'Brien of Love Lies Bleeding fame. You have David Corns, but he's not part of that group, but the future Superman is in there somewhere.
Today out of Bempe.
I was saving him for last. How dare you?
I jumped on your line.
Of course, building up to Tunde out of Bempe. In what I think can be somewhat accurately described as, like, the Philip Seymour Hoffman role.
Sure.
He does not get this. He has the same sort of energy.
I think Brandon Perea as Twins, We Got Twins, is kind of the loose canon, more Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yes. I mean, like, none of these characters get to have anything close to the kind of fun that Philip Seymour Hoffman got to have in Twister when he's calling big tornadoes fatties.
talking about the suck zone, although the suck zone also makes a cameo in this movie.
But you go a long way with me just putting Tunde Adebimpe in your movie, and then you lose points by not having him sing. But, you know, I will take, you know, some Tunde not getting used particularly well over no Tunde.
You just like his presence, especially where you're like, oh, this isn't like a studio being like, who's hot and on the list? Like, no one was demanding to put him in this movie. Like, I don't know what the story is, but it adds so much, like,
and it was
quality to that ensemble.
It was the same with Katie O'Brien, who I can't remember the details, but I think her wife was, her partner was tweeting about how Lee Isaac Chung, like, put her in this movie as a favor because she needed the money to like get by through the pandemic. And she's just like an interesting actress and she's good in the movie. And she's obviously great in Love Lies Bleeding. And it's like that kind of thing where it's like he, especially in the smaller roles where the studio was less invested in who was going to move the needle. He just found interesting, good people for the role. I mean, I wish we got to spend more time with them, but, like, it's cool that they're there.
Isn't it anything to explain how Paul Scheer wound up in this movie?
I do not know.
Just
but
right
I
at
think
the end.
When you need. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but, like, when you need. Like, I'll say this. Twister is It Happened One Night. It's screwball comedy mixed with a disaster movie with then nascent special effects and trying to meld the two. My take on Twisters is that it is a modern romantic comedy all the way down to the Glenn Powell of it all, mixed in with a classic Amblin adventure. And it is an Amblin movie, as was Twister. But you do need it to fulfill that assessment. A hard pivot towards the end of the movie into rom-com territory. And I think in order to thread that needle and to navigate that tone change, that code switch, whatever you want to call it, you need a Paul Scheer to come in and just like physically grab the audience and steer them into a different tone. And he gets the job done.
Sure, you thought this was going to be a climate change drama, but don't forget, it's a rom-com.
I mean, look, they do make nods to that the storms are only going to keep getting worse. They don't have a solution for it. They don't mention climate change, obviously.
Well, I mean, Daisy Edgar Jones
definitely has a solution to it. That's in diapers up into tornadoes. And
no, this is a movie about someone who is, and it's like a little fanciful, I think. I don't know. I haven't done the research, but like she has essentially found a way to stop tornadoes. And you know, the first movie was all about measuring tornadoes in the hopes of buying people an extra 10 seconds to seek shelter so you could better understand the patterns, the way they moved. At this point, Daisy Edgar Jones' character has a technology using polymers and silver iodide, whatever the fuck, that she can literally launch something into a tornado and stop it. And it all feels like vaguely credible.
Although, did it ever occur to you, so like you've experienced diapers in your life as a parent, like have you got these polymers absorbing the moisture, isn't there's this like huge thump of stuff gonna fall down to earth after a while? they tell you it's non-toxic, so it's not gonna like mess up the fields or anything, but I was just like, where is this all gonna go?
It's a prototype. It's you don't ever get the sense in this movie that she's gonna cure the world of tornadoes forever overnight. She's just looking to see if it is possible to tame these things.
She's trying to do something.
Glenn Powell's character is like a tornado wrangler, down to his "this isn't my first tornado" t-shirt, and when he just basically wants to ride the tornadoes and launch fireworks in them and make content for his own reasons that are explained in the movie.
Yeah,
I think it's a good balance. The only like the trick of it that I sort of started seeing more and more of at the end is like the tornadoes, super fun. Until the movie needs them to be not super fun. And I kind of felt that a little bit more than I felt in the original Twister.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just because the original Twister was like, not only are there townspeople, but Helen Hunt's father was killed by a serial killer tornado.
And she's gonna get revenge.
Every time she sees an F5, she sees the face of her father's serial killer again.
There is a great moment in Twister around the Shining scene where she looks at the tornado and you can feel her like being inches away from saying, "That's the tornado that killed my father."
Well, I went back and forth for a long time, and you guys can weigh in on this. Like, it has an equivalent of the Helen Hunt scene at the beginning where you've got Daisy Edgar Jones and her team getting killed by a tornado, and it's 10 times more intense than the scene in the original Twister. Like, it goes really hard, and it makes it kind of hard to pivot back to, "Oh, they're having a really good time shooting fireworks into this tornado," and you're following that character having a hard time herself. And part of it, I think, is that Daisy Edgar Jones is just not great in this role. David, I think you went kind of lenient on her and her in your reviews.
I'm often too nice to actors, but like I do think that it's not her fault so much as the fact that like the character is so entombed in her own trauma that she doesn't really get anything to do other than like slowly break out of her shell.
I guess so. But yeah, I wondered if it was a mistake to make that scene so harrowing. It's really effective, but you're just like, oh yeah, okay, so now we're just gonna have fun with this too. It sets the tone in an odd way.
But I think there's a fun conflict there between like how unseriously Glenn Powell's character takes it, because he's got a more serious reason than he lets on at first for wanting to do this, but he has not been touched in the same way that she has, it's just like a completely different attitude for it. And it is a classic rom-com energy, right? Where they're like completely at odds with one another about this, and they have to sort of learn to find a happy medium. And I think that works. I mean, like, yeah, the first 5 minutes of this movie is almost too scary for what follows.
But it's really scary.
You can't make this movie, you know, which is making light entertainment out of a natural disaster that kills several dozen people every year in this country. Which is baffling to me in theory, as like calling the Carolina hockey team the Hurricanes. Like, why would you name a hockey team after a weather phenomenon that kills people? But they're trying to split the difference there as well. I mean, they want this to be blockbuster fun, but they also need to sort of acknowledge the threat that these things pose and not be too glib about the damage that they cause. And I do think that Mark L. Smith's script, which has a story by credit from Joseph Kosinski,
sure does,
of Top Gun fame, it does a good job of being like, tornadoes are serious. They do leave behind real damage, but we can still make big screen fun entertainment with it. It's the same spirit that gets you the Shining scene in the first movie. And we get another iteration of tornado hits movie theater in this movie, and it's also effective. And so I didn't have a problem with any of that.
Twisters.
I had a good time with Twisters. I had a great time.
No,
like, it's a good movie.
I would argue Daisy Edgar Jones is a liability in the movie, but like Glenn Powell kind of really makes up for it.
Like, they just this is the first time I was seeing Daisy Edgar Jones. I'd care more, but like I've liked her in enough things.
Did you see the crawdad sing? I never saw that one.
I did. And I'm like, you know what? Like, not on your life could I ever make that part work, but like she, you know, she's selling it.
No one would have cast you in that part. I'm sorry.
Probably not. But like, it would have been an interesting choice. But I think she does what she can in that role. I mean, I think she could be, you know, she was in Fresh, right? Which I don't think is particularly successful movie, but I thought she was fine in that. Like, I think, you know, she's taking, it's always difficult when you have these actors that are coming up and you lambast them over the choices they make. It's like, I don't know the choices that were available to her, particularly around the strikes and whatnot. Everyone needs, gotta eat. I would love if as her career goes on to see a greater range of range hasn't been the problem, but like a greater range in the quality of her projects. But I think, you know, still Normal People is the best thing that she's done. I don't know. I like seeing her movies. I don't know if anyone really could have saved this part as written. So,
you know what? Once someone suggested me the idea that Haley Lou Richardson could have played that part, I kind of can't let go of it.
No, that's
she made
that
this
is
movie
really
so good.
Yeah.
If Glenn Powell had been trusted as a star more, they wouldn't have been like, well, Daisy Edgar Jones could like open a movie. She made the, I mean, Crawdads was a genuine hit because she doesn't have I'm from Oklahoma vibes about her. I'm just going to throw that out there.
I'm also, but like Haley Lou Richardson. Does exclusively interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, almost exclusively interesting things.
You're saying she wouldn't have been in Twisters?
Yeah, I'm not saying that she wouldn't have been in Twisters. I mean, she was in like a Netflix rom-com about like meeting some British boy on an airplane or something. I don't know. But she has, I would not want her necessarily to spend 7 months or however long on the set knowing that she, there are interesting things she could have been doing.
She sure did make a Netflix rom-com about meeting a boy.
And I wonder
I thought you were making that up.
No, I wasn't. I would never joke about Haley Lou Richardson's career. And I wonder if she and Glenn Powell might have a little bit more of like a big brother, little sister vibe.
Mm.
Maybe
fine, they just put
work.
Zoe Deutsch in it. She and Glenn Powell already have a thing going. Just keep it.
I mean,
keep going.
Glenn Powell could have made this movie work with me in the Daisy Edgar Jones role. I mean, like,
that is very
he's
true.
So fucking charming. He's so fucking charming. It really, I don't think. It probably would have sunk the movie, but maybe not as much as any other movie.
Glenn Powell and it sort of to bring it back around. Glenn Powell and Maura Tierney show up and like blast through the most difficult part of this movie with charisma, and the most difficult part
most
of this
difficult
movie
in terms of just like we got to get to the last act, let's get this
it
over
is
with.
It is the most Amblin part of the movie, which is like, well, go to the barn laboratory, and I'm just like, well, what do you mean there's a fucking barn laboratory? They're like, what do you mean they're were you not expecting a barn laboratory and a new backstory? Because
it is really Back to the Future with the model of the town and the like in the barn with some straw laying
and I'm just
around.
Like, oh, okay then. And like the movie powers through because Glenn Powell and Muratini are able to like charisma through that weird part of the movie.
And like, yeah, in a perfect world, a studio lets, if the Isaac Chung wants to make us a disaster movie, which he very much did, they let him make an original one if that's what he wanted to do. And of course, even if he wanted to make an original disaster movie, they wouldn't have let him, certainly not to the tune of $200 million, which is an outrageous budget for a movie like this, but whatever. Short of us actually getting back to a place where we let filmmakers make original movies at a certain scale, this is kind of the best we can hope for, in that you have a genuinely good director not making something that sort of ticks all boxes, that everyone can enjoy, that doesn't feel like just, you know, bald studio product that has some heart and character to it, and is smart about how it's how it's updating its property for modern times.
We've been having a good run of these. So we have this. We have A Quiet Place Day One, which Katie and I talked about last week.
Yep, bring that up. Mm-hmm.
And I think even further back,
we have Deadpool and Wolverine.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sean Levy finally getting to make his passion project.
Sean Levy, everyone's favorite auteur, who is finally stretching his wing.
I was going to say The First Omen, which I recently caught up on Hulu, is like surprisingly a movie of its time, even though it is also a Omen franchise movie, and that franchise is old.
And that's another thing that has in common with something like Long Legs is like, you know, take heart, whether you love the movie or not, how great to see these horror movies that are like actually directed with intention and vision.
Just these franchise movies, not even these horror movies. Yeah. So like,
well, sure.
If we are going to live in a franchise obsessed world, these are the type of movies that are cool. They're like little bubbles of fun inside of things that didn't need to be.
Yeah, I guess that we'll see if Alien Romulus can keep that trend going.
We'll see about that.
It's so dangerous that I've let myself get excited for that movie.
I hadn't until we were having this conversation. I was like, oh, I mean, anticipation for that than The Crow?
I don't think Fede Alvarez has ever made a movie that I like truly enjoyed. I mean, he also made The Girl in the Spider's Web, which is his last attempt at, not his last attempt at making a franchise film because there was Evil Dead, but I just don't trust this guy, but everything he says about Alien Romulus, I'm like, yes, that's what I want to hear. Mm-hmm. And just more alien that is in the continuity, that's in space, it's having people, you know, keeping the monster hidden, having young people, well, not necessarily young, I mean, they're young in this movie, they didn't have to be in the original Alien, picked off by an alien. Like, this is all shit I want to see, please don't fuck it up, I just really want this movie to be good.
Well, if not, we always have Lee Daniels making a horror movie at long last, so there's something to look forward to in August.
Twisters! It's in theaters this weekend.
Twisters.
Go check it
Wear
out.
Wear a cowboy hat. Dress up. Make it an event. It's worth
it. If you like it,
if you feel it.
If you feel it.
Chase it.
Chase it.
Come on. Get your catchphrases right.
Yeah.
That does it for this week's show. Next week, it's going to be an all David's extravaganza. Both Patches and I are going to be gone on very different beaches on different parts of the world. And you guys get the honor of talking about Deadpool and Wolverine. It's Mr. Marvel versus Mr. I saw a Marvel marathon for punishment. I'm excited.
I
will be listening.
12 hours of Marvel content ago, he saw a Marvel marathon.
Deadpool and Wolverine and the Dave and David Spectacular coming up next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
He wasn't Matt Patches, but if he was here, he'd be Matt Patches and tell you to go to fightinginthewarroom.com.
Yeah, he would.
And I am David Ehrlich, and you can find me on the shits. You know, those places. You know by now, you can find all of us together on the Apple Podcast app, Fighting the War Room. Leave us a review, whether you live in Omaha or any other city in this great planet. And you don't even have to live in a city. You can live in a town. You can live in a hamlet. You can live in a village. A cult-like community. Whatever it is. Probably going to need cell phone reception. Leave us a review. We'll read it live on the show.
And you can email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me at DA7E on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd. And on the Trial by Content podcast, where we're covering House of the Dragon. And I think if you're in New York, you could see me on August 5th in Bryant Park in the afternoon. Talking about what? MCU, Reign of Marvel Studios, the book I wrote.
You're coming to New York? I'm not going to be here. I'm going to be in California.
Yeah, well, I'm just dipping in and out for Doolittle Book Talk. It'll be fun.
Everyone's zipping all over the country these days. I'm Katie Rich. As I mentioned, I did a podcast about the Emmy nominations with Jordan Hoffman. It's called the Prestige Junkie Podcast. There's a newsletter that goes with it. You should subscribe to both at The Ankler. You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky, although I took Twitter back off my phone because of certain news events, and I said I don't need to deal with this, so we'll see how long that can stay. But anyway, I'm there at Katie Rich on Letterboxd at Katie Rich. Also, you can find all of us on those social media places at FITWR, where I would like to hear who you think is the Philip Seymour Hoffman of Twisters. Or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Twisters in theaters this weekend, what's a weather crisis you'd like to see an upcoming movie about?
Thanks for listening, and some of us will be back talking to you next week.
I'm done.